Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe, with a very robust program for you this fine Thursday afternoon, April 14th. I'll be talking with Jim Van Buskirk and Karen Sondheim about the events celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Hormel Center at the San Francisco Public Library. Graham Lustig, director of the Oakland Ballet, will share details about the company's 51st season. He has some guests with him to share the choral aspect of the ballet's programs. Plus, I'll be talking with Graham about not only about the season, but we also have Cyrano de Bergerac down at Theater Works. We'll hear from the main actor involved in that. Singers Matt Hanscom and Kirk Doherty talk about their roles in Opera San Jose's upcoming production of Andre Previn's A Streetcar Named Desire. Plus, we'll have some live fiddle music courtesy of Colm O'Rain. He's in studio providing a preview of next week's musical tribute to Ireland's poet patriots up at Grace Cathedral. Stay with us. Let's get right started and start by going to the library. 20th anniversary of the Hormel Center at the San Francisco Public Library. Karen Sondheim, program manager of the Hormel LGBTQIA Center since 2007, is responsible for acquiring archives, collecting books, films, and other research materials, and putting on public programs and exhibitions on LGBT history and culture for San Francisco Public Library. Jim Van Buskirk is the former program manager of the Hormel Gay and Lesbian Center, did that from 1992 to 2007. He is guest curator of the current exhibit, queerest.library.ever. Hashtag Hormel at 20. We'll be talking about all of the events surrounding that anniversary. He's also author of Gay by the Bay, A History of Queer Culture in the San Francisco Bay Area and Chronicle Books, and co-editor of Love, Castro Street. And it's a pleasure to welcome you both to our studios here.
Thank you.
And I'm trying to get audio here, so I think we need to do this and that. There you are. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. It's a three-ring circus here at KLW, and we got full studios and a full rack of guests here for open air. Well, I'd like to start with, 20 years of the Hormel Center. How did it get started? Was it an idea of Jim Hormel's, or was he just the bankroller of it?
Well, it was actually under the auspices of Art Agnos when he was mayor, and Steve Coulter is the brains behind it. He visited the Schomburg Center for African American Culture at New York Public Library and was so inspired, and the library was developing affinity centers, and he thought, what a great idea to have gay and lesbian affinity center. So as part of the fabric of the new main library, which opened just about today in 1996, there was the African American Center, the Chinese Center, the Filipino Center, the Environmental Center, the Teen Center, and the Gay and Lesbian Center.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about curating such a vast center. There must be an amazing amount of material that you have to draw from.
Well, we are going to be exhibiting 20 years of archival collections, and we are going to be organizing them into various categories. For example, we have a whole section on lesbian literary love, which includes the collections we have of writers like Celeste West, Anne Bannon, Catherine Forrest, Jewel Gomez, Michelle T., and others. We also have a section on how we see ourselves, LGBTQ images through time, including the comic artist A.J. Shapiro, and photographs by Chloe Atkins, who took pictures of lesbian nightclubs in the 90s. And other section includes community, how we come together, bars, sports teams, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And there's a special event on the 23rd of April called Teens and Queens, the opening program.
Yes, that is on Saturday, April 23rd, and it will open with queer teens, part of a group called the Rising Rhythm Project. And it's an intergenerational program. It's very important for us to look into the future and to bring young people into our center. So we'll have the Rising Rhythm Project. Ambassador James Hormel will be there to say some words. We are also going to present a new documentary, a short documentary on the Hormel Center, including speakers from the very beginning, as Jim mentioned, like Steve Coulter, Ambassador Hormel, and others. And we'll be looking at the past, also the present, and the future, how we envision the future of the Hormel Center. And it will end with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, our very good friends, giving us a blessing.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Jim, you must know quite a bit about the Sisters through your work of, as a historian of gay culture here in San Francisco.
Absolutely. What's not to love about the Sisters of a Perpetual Indulgence? It's not an event unless they're there.
Could you tell us a little bit about them for those that aren't familiar with the rather elaborate costumes? Just know them from their elaborate costumes.
Yes, and they're actually much more serious. They're activists. They're philanthropists. They support all kinds of important organizations and activities.
They really are nuns.
Yeah, indeed.
They're
yeah.
generous. They raise money for all sorts of organizations.
And they are so supportive of the library and all our activities. All we have to do is call. In fact, one of our librarians is one of the nuns.
Oh, fantastic.
So
that's
a wonderful connection that we work all too often.
Uh-huh. So the Hormel Center, when it was created 20 years ago, what was everything just disparate and all over the city prior to that?
Well, I started getting involved in 1992, and what I did was survey the collections to see what we had. And the San Francisco Public Library had done a really, really good job collecting materials, but things had gotten lost, things had gotten stolen, there were holes in the collection. And so we really had to envision, what is this brand new project? Who's going to use it? How are they going to use it? And the archival component was one of the earliest and most important. So we have, as Karen mentioned, the personal papers and or organizational records of all kinds of local people. So we have like Feminist Bookstore News. We have Harvey Milk's personal papers. We have just incredible collection. So this will just be the proverbial tip of the iceberg, but we're calling it Celebrating the Past, Creating the Future, because what we do is these are not dusty archival boxes that nobody looks at. These are full of exciting materials, and we have a long, long, long list of documentaries, publications, books that have used the materials to create other artworks or other historical documentation. So they're vibrant and they're constantly in use.
Mm-hmm. So with the treasure trove of things we have there, you must be planning well ahead for specialty exhibitions and have people working on things that are happening next year or the year after even.
Yes. We have been working on this exhibit for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
So I can't say exactly what we're doing after this. However, we pretty much have year-round exhibitions.
Right.
Sometimes it's history, sometimes it's archival collections, sometimes it's an art exhibit. But I promise there will be a lot to love and visit.
One of the fun things is the aspect of the collection that's at the Eureka Valley branch, which we're calling Queer and Quirky, Objectifying Ourselves. And so we have on display a gay Monopoly game, a gay trivia, the gay Bob doll from 1977. We have a Sisters of Perpetual.
I remember that.
Remember that?
Gay Bob.
So lots, an Artemis Cafe coffee mug. Just symbols from the community that sort of anchor us either chronologically or geographically to say, you know, we've been here a long time and a lot has happened, and we need to document that and celebrate that.
Sure. I remember that's my branch, the Eureka Valley, nearby in Lower Haight, and they had a wonderful exhibition on some of Harvey Milk ephemera
right.
recently.
And some of that will be included in this because we're highlighting past exhibits. So we have the reversing vandalism exhibit. We have the shades of the LGBTQI photographic exhibit. So we're highlighting the 20 years. I'm sort of the first 10 and Karen's sort of the second 10 and we're...
Well, one thing I want to say about the second 10, recently we digitized a bunch of the Frameline International LGBT Film Festival archives. Back in 2007, they gave us all their stuff, and we wanted to preserve them. So far, we have digitized 39 of their films, which may not sound like a lot, but it's a big, expensive project. And in the exhibit, we're going to have a film loop, a video loop, showing little clips of some of the films, including going way back to 1951, a French film called Olivia, a lesbian activity in a boarding school. Things like that that people wouldn't ever get to see.
That's Karen Sondheim here with Jim Van Buskirk talking about Hormel at 20. Fourth floor of the...
Third. It's multi-venue. So the biggest part of the exhibit is on the lower level in the Jewett Gallery. Then there's a whole nother part of the exhibit on the third floor in the Hormel Center. And then, of course, the Eureka Valley Harvey Milk branch. And on the sixth floor, we also have...
Out at the library, which was our 10th anniversary. So we're revisiting that after it's traveled all over the country.
All happening at the main branch and other branches, by the way, but the main exhibit's happening and the Hormel Center is at the San Francisco Public Library main branch down right next nearby the City Hall. Thanks so much for coming in today, and we look forward to exploring the incredible things that will be happening over these next several months. More information at sfpl.org/Hormel at 20. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you
for having us.
Some of the music that will be featured in the 51st season of the Oakland Ballet Company. Getting underway tonight at the Malonga Caskelord Center for the Arts in Oakland, as well as Friday at 8, Saturday a matinee and an evening performance. Then the group comes to San Francisco, to the Brava Theater here in San Francisco on Thursday the 21st, and then off to Hayward on the 23rd. Here to talk about the season and some of the special events happening this year are... Graham Lustig, since his appointment as artistic director in 2010, Graham has revitalized Oakland Ballet and helped the organization reclaim its position as a leading San Francisco Bay Area arts institution and first-rate dance company. For the past six seasons, Lustig has presented the critically acclaimed production of The Nutcracker at the Oakland's Paramount Theater. And in collaboration with Oakland Unified School District, we've seen Oakland Ballet expand its educational outreach program to reach more than 5,000 local children each year. Also a dancer himself, Graham trained at the Royal Ballet School in London and danced with the Dutch National Ballet and Birmingham Royal Ballet. Graham Lustig, a very happy welcome to you here at KLW.
Wonderful to meet you. Thank you.
He's also joined by a couple of the collaborators that are involved with the this season. Derek Tam, who is the Berkeley Community Chamber Singers, it's the outreach ensemble of the Berkeley Community Chorus and Orchestra, and that's the music that we heard coming in. Thank you for joining us, Derek.
Pleasure to be here.
And we're also joined by Nona Brown of the Inspirational Music Collective, an eclectic group of Bay Area vocalists singing contemporary gospel music. Welcome to you, Nona.
Thank you, David.
So, Graham, let's start with why you decided to involve choral folks in the ballet this season.
It's always such a joy to have live music for dance. I grew up singing choirs. I have friends who still sing in choirs. And the idea of bringing the sort of harmonic beauty of the voice to the spiritual and physical beauty of the dancers in collaboration. So the program became a cappella, Our Bodies Sing, collaboration with three different dances, and two of them are newly commissioned, and three different local choirs.
And Derek, how did you choose the music that is being presented as this program?
It was a collaboration with the choreographer, Val Canaparoli. He was really inspired by the music of Stephen Foster, one of the principal composers of American music in the mid-19th century, around the time of the Civil War. Most of Stephen Foster's music was written for the home, which means it was written for whoever was singing in the house with a very simple piano arrangement. So it's been a great pleasure to translate that sort of music into an a cappella setting that is also more harmonically inflected by the 150 years that have come since.
Mm. Graham, particularly about Beautiful Dreamer, are you transferring that simplicity of sound into the choreography? What will we see for the Beautiful Dreamer aspect? How many dancers and how is it set?
Val Canaparoli chose all 12 dancers in the company, and so it's an ensemble work which features groups but also trios and duos. And Beautiful Dreamer begins as a pas de deux, and at the end of his life, Stephen Foster had a relationship with an African-American woman, and this work is widely believed as being dedicated to her. But sadly, he died penniless on the streets of New York, and he never actually heard this tune he wrote was never published until after he died, so he actually never heard this music. Kind of tragically beautiful.
Oh, man. So there's more of music from, shall we say, the Great American Songbook involved in this that Derek's also involved with, Night and Day. Is that part of your aspect of things here?
So that's just a selection. The Berklee Chamber Singers do a wide range of music, all the way from Stephen Foster to Palestrina, also to modern music, and so I just wanted to show off a little bit.
Oh,
of
okay.
Range.
I thought that was.
But
part
it does.
Of the
it's not
well.
Part of the ballet.
My bad.
For better or worse, I'm so excited about translating the music of Stephen Foster into a cappella arrangements, and to see it come to life. To see these arrangements, these songs, many of which I was not aware of, being translated to dance. I think the connection between song and dance is very deep. Unlike playing an instrument, you are blessed with the voice you are given. And it's a very intimate form of music making that everyone gets to do. And dance is very similar to that. To see that translated
sure,
into motion.
Sure, and I bet you once Graham Lustig hears you do Cole Porter, you might be choreographing some Cole Porter
Cole
down
Porter
the line.
Too, yes, we work night and days anyway, so
that's for sure. Let's involve Nona Brown on this. You're adding a gospel element to the to the mix.
Yes, this has been a new experience for myself, and it's been the most amazing experience. I have to agree with Derek that there is a connection that takes place with the live music and the dance that I have never experienced, opposed to seeing dance to a CD. So we are so honored to bring our piece, to bring in the good old spiritual songs, and to be a part of this. It's just been a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. Graham, how is the choreography effect reflecting that?
Nona's singers are on stage with the dancers. So when we are doing the Battle of Jericho, they stand in a very strong diagonal. The dancers oppose them, and they are trying to bring the wall of Jericho down, but it's kind of a physical battle between the singers and the dancers. So you feel this sense of tension. And so the singers are very much integral to this, the heart of this work. And later in the piece, one gentleman comes forward, and he recites part of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. Meanwhile, the dancers are performing around him. And I think it brings a beauty and a power that is already inherent in that, in his words. And it just brings it home to you in a much more physical and more powerful way.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about the rest of the spring season.
Janice Garrett and Charles Moulton are a husband and wife team who live in Oakland. And unusually, they choreograph together. Mm-hmm. So they've made a new work. It's called Divining. And the music they chose is 1,000 years old, composed by Hildegard von Bingen.
Oh, wonderful, yeah.
Benedictine nun from the 11th century, philosopher, scientist, and incidentally also a remarkable spiritual composer. And their work features 12 dancers, and it's incredibly powerful. There are just fluxes and waves of dance coming across the stage. Meanwhile, Karen Clark and her singers are singing this music, which is unmetered, vocal music that is both spiritual and transformational, meditative, and kind of just kind of makes your heart soar. So this combination of this unworldly sound and the strong physicality of the dancers is a very sort of heady collaboration, and I think very powerful.
And then there are a lot of community elements that are associated with not only the ballet performances. You've got a community dance class coming up this Saturday in the morning.
We do indeed, yes. And then on Sunday we have East Bay Dances. And that's the second year we're doing this. Of course, there is so much to celebrate in the East Bay. And this time we're putting our arms around different other smaller dance companies, ballet companies, contemporary companies, a Chinese folk dance group, and even a group of 12 cloggers who are coming in from Concord to do some wonderful early American clogging for us. So
nice.
It's a really diverse program. That's Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock.
And then following the matinee performance this Saturday, also at the Malonga Center, you'll have a Meet the Artists panel discussion to talk about not only those programs, but the rest of the season, I imagine.
That's right, indeed.
Circling back to this tonight and the upcoming performances with Nona Brown as well as Derek, we're going to hear some of Nona's group sing a little bit. What are we going to hear in that cut?
I believe you're going to hear Faith Can. This is actually my original composition that I composed for this scene, closing scene.
Great. Nona Brown involved with the Oakland Ballet's 51st season. Thank you all for coming in today. We look forward to seeing some wonderful dance in Oakland and here in San Francisco.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe faith can. To love. I believe faith can.
Through your lens of faith and see things different one day. We'll all be free. From despair to hope,
I believe faith can.
Faith to love,
I believe faith can.
Look through your lens of faith and see things different
one day. We'll all be free.
We'll all be free.
One day.
Brown's original work, part of the Oakland Ballet's 51st season, which you can catch tonight at the Malonga Cascalord Center for the Arts in Oakland. Also tomorrow night at 8, Saturday, April 16, the full day of events, including a community dance event and post-matinee discussion with the artists and an evening performance. And once again, you'll be able to catch it here in San Francisco at the Brava Theater next Thursday, the 21st at 8 p.m. Information at oaklandballet.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Still to come, we'll hear some live fiddle music from Colmo Rehn. We'll also hear about the production that TheaterWorks is doing down in Silicon Valley way of a new adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac. Next, also down Peninsula Way at our friends at the Opera San Jose, a production of Andre Previn's adaptation of Tennessee Williams' Pulitzer Prize winning play, A Streetcar Named Desire. A couple of return, well, at least one of the folks that I've had here on KLW in Open Air returns to talk about that. Resident tenor Kirk Dougherty, who's singing the role of Harold Mitchell. Mr. Dougherty most recently appeared as Don Jose in Carmen and performed the role of Cavaradossi in Tosca earlier this season. Welcome back to you, Kirk.
Yeah, pleasure to be back. Thank you very much.
Indeed. He's joined by resident baritone Matthew Hanscom, who will sing the role of Stanley Kowalski. Mr. Hanscom has appeared in every production this season, most recently as Escamillo in Carmen, as well as Count Almaviva in The Marriage of Figaro and Scarpia in Tosca. It's so much fun to say those Italian characters. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Well, Andre Previn, not the first composer one thinks about when you think about something like a Tennessee Williams play. How does he do in adapting the music?
Well, from my perspective, I think it's a kind of cross between a play, an opera, and a movie soundtrack, and a lot of it. Goes along very verbatim. The text is very closely the same as the play, and I think it fits quite nice. A lot of different musical vocabulary is used. A lot of jazz numbers and a lot of 20th century contemporary kind of feel to the music. And yeah, it's very. I think it's very riveting.
Hmm. It's one of, you know, speaking of opera, and it's one of those operas that is always going to have to be set at that time in New Orleans. It's not like a Carmen that you can set in leather and on a rock somewhere. It's always going to have to be this very story of Tennessee Williams. So tell us a little bit about your character.
I play the character of Harold Mitchell, and he is a friend of Stanley Kowalski. They go way back to... the war. They served as engineers together in an engineer division, and they work on a plant in New Orleans. And now they're buddies, and they have poker games, and they go through life, and they know Stanley has a wife, and at one of these encounters, Harold Mitchell meets. Blanche Dubois, that's the sister of Stanley's wife, Stella. And they hit it off pretty well, and he wants to ask her out on a date. And so they go on a date. And much of what they reveal to each other about their lives and their dreams is the subject of a lot of the second act. And as the play continues, my character is... Mitch realizes that he's not exactly being told the entire truth about Blanche, and it's something that he doesn't want to see but has to see. And the character that does that is Matt's character, Stanley Kowalski, reveals this truth.
Stanley.
Stanley, of course, is from people who know Marlon Brando's iconic portrayal of him in the film. He has that magical moment in the film where he screams out, "Stella! Stella!" And really, he is, he's described in the play in the stage directions as someone who takes, radiating from the very core of his being, is the joy that he takes in the giving of and the taking of pleasure from women. Mm. And all other things in his life come from that sort of central
animalistic
element.
Animalistic, yeah.
Exactly. And he's and as a result, you know, he is he can be a very dangerous man. And he is actually a really bad drunk, and unfortunately he spends most of the play drinking. And so he, you know, I'm not spoiling anything by telling you that he commits a terrible rape on Blanche Dubois and lies about it to his wife. They have a young he beats his wife in the earlier on in the play, and they have a young son, and it's a very tragic thing. But at the end of the show, rather than face the uncertainty that you know a modern day woman would certainly come to. She decides that she can't believe the things that he's done, and she's going to stay with him.
Needless to say, not soon to be a Disney adaptation.
Oh, of, no.
No, there's no, no Disney princess of Blanche DuBois. No, not at all.
No, it's a gritty play, it's, yeah. And it's a gritty opera. So,
Brad Dalton returns to direct and is also the set designer after having directed the season opener, Tosca. He's directed some of Opera San Jose's most really acclaimed operas, including Rigoletto and Magic Flute, Madame Butterfly, a host of others. And in the role of Blanche, we have Ariana Strahl making her company debut. And mm-hmm. soprano Stacey Tappan is also making her operatic debut with San Jose, appearing as Stella. Nice cast of characters to be working with.
Fantastic.
Absolutely.
And conducted by
Maestro Ming Luke.
Who
I believe is a regular conductor with the San Francisco Ballet. Mm-hmm.
And he'll actually General Director Larry Hancock will be giving a free 45-minute talk to folks about the opera at the California Theater before each performance of Streetcar Named Desire. Those performances are the 16th, starting opening on Saturday. There's a Sunday matinee, and then it continues for four more dates. Information at operasj.org. Andre Previn's A Streetcar Named Desire. Kirk Dougherty, Matthew Hanscom, thanks for coming in. Maybe you could help set me up a cut we're going to hear. I've got two at the ready. Maybe you can choose them for me. I Can Hardly Stand It, or I Can Smell the Sea Air.
I Can Smell the Sea Air is the heartbreaking aria that Blanche sings at the almost right at the end of the third act, so it sort of brings the curtain down on the whole piece, and it really speaks to her desire within her character to not face the atrocities that have really happened to her in her life. She's really fallen from grace at this point. And she says earlier on that she just wants to find enchantment. She wants to make magic. And this is her retreating into her imagination and just imagining a very beautiful way to leave the world, even though her reality is never going to be anything this poetic.
Gentlemen, thanks for coming in, and I wish you a wonderful performance.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Fleming singing from that original release of Andre Previn's A Streetcar Named Desire as Blanche in that Tennessee Williams classic. The adaptation by Andre Previn is at Opera San Jose. You'll hear Ariana Strahl making her company debut singing that role of Blanche. And my guests Matthew Hanscom and Kirk will also be singing in that production, Kirk Dougherty. Information at operasj.org. Still to come, we'll hear about an extravaganza that's going to be up at the Grace Cathedral, Ireland's Poet Patriots, a musical commemoration of and reflection upon Ireland's struggle for independence through the singing of poems, lyrics, and writings of 10 of Ireland's great poet patriots. We'll hear about that shortly on Open Air. TheatreWorks Silicon Valley continues its 2015-16 season with Cyrano, a new adaptation by Michael Hollinger and Aaron Posner of Edmund Rostand's classic Cyrano de Bergerac. The production will be directed by Robert Kelly, with performances through May 1st at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts on Castro Street. Joining me in studio to talk about the production is one of the cast members, Darren Bridget. Among his many TheatreWorks roles, Darren was most recently seen in Peter and the Starcatcher. His regional credits include 15 seasons at the Marin Shakespeare Company and numerous appearances with, among other groups, Marin Theater Company, the Magic Theater, Center Rep, Orlando Shakespeare Theater, the Laguna Playhouse, Aurora, and ACT. Darren, welcome to KLW.
Thank you, David.
Well, for those of us who need a refresher on this classic Cyrano de Bergerac story and haven't seen the wonderful Steve Martin film from 1987, Roxanne, why don't you give us a refresher on Cyrano and his basic premise and story?
That's a good question, the one that I wasn't prepared for. A synopsis. I studied it. Cyrano de Bergerac. Cyrano is a Superman. He's amazing at swordplay. He's actually a real person, Cyrano de Bergerac. He wrote a book that's still with us. I forget the name. It's about the moon. anyway, he's this amazing sword fighter. He's a lover of words and poetry. He's a larger-than-life figure. He also has a larger-than-life nose, which he's tortured by privately, unless you make fun of it, and then he sort of publicly tortures you for making fun of his nose. He's in love with Roxanne, who's his cousin. He points out that it's his second cousin, so it's okay. She has no idea. She's in love with somebody else. Christian, who's serves with Cyrano de Bergerac in the Gascony Guard. This is around the time of Richelieu, Three Musketeers.
So there's much buckling of swashes.
There's lots of buckling and swash. Yes, that's well said. Yeah, a lot of that. The story is really a love story, but it's an unrequited love story about two people who belong together but don't see it.
J. Anthony Crane making his TheatreWorks debut as the swashbuckling lead of Cyrano. Yeah. This production has actors performing multiple roles, including yourself, your Lignière and Montfleury. Who are those characters?
Lignière is the drunk, which is actually how I prepared for this interview. Montfleury is the hammy actor, which I guess is just natural, so I didn't need to prepare that part. There's a cast of characters that participate, and it's actually the original production by Rostand is, I think it's a cast of like 100 people, which is why it's just not practical to produce it anymore.
Sure.
So this version
is... At least not with equity players.
No, certainly not. Yeah, yeah. That's one of the benefits of this version is it pares it down to more theatrical presentation of the play with actors doubling up on roles and taking advantage of theater's ability to represent a scene where he defeats 100 people at a bridge. Not a bridge, actually. It's a port. With swords, you know, so we have actors tumbling in, but it's the same actors that roll in, and we use lighting and staging to represent what this feels like.
So, set in the time of the Three Musketeers, Richelieu, is it a very traditional setting that you guys are doing as well with the froofy costumes and the big hair and all that?
Yeah. What do you mean by that? You're not commenting on how I look right now, right? Just because I wear this all the time.
The power of radio.
Yeah, right. I know. yeah, it is. The costumes are great, actually. We start out in our street clothes, and then over the course of the introduction into these characters, they sort of blend into the costumes that you expect. I'm wigged as Lignière, and the Montfleury costume is giant pumpkin pants and feathers and gold embroidery and stuff. Yeah, it's but they're great. They're really beautiful. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that represented on stage. There's this big beautiful moon that they created for this show. So you sort of track the moon throughout the show from scene to scene. At one point, the moon is it's a full two stories high.
Wow!
And it was built so that it could. Because it's lit from within. It's like a light box. It looks amazing on stage.
Neat.
And it's a slight reference to the book that I can't remember the name of that Cyrano actually wrote about the moon.
All right, we'll look that up.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, you know that movie where the early that like that first film where the spaceship
oh,
crashes
the man
into
in the moon. Yeah,
man in the moon. I think that's what it is. Okay. I think it's the man in the moon.
Uh-huh. This production is being billed as being even more humorous than the Steve Martin Roxanne. How is the humor element working into the plot?
Well, there's a lot of humor in it. I mean, that scene that people remember so much from Steve Martin where he makes fun of the guy for not being able to mock his nose well and proceeds to mock his own nose, that's in the play. There's a lot of humor in it, actually. It leavens how insufferable Cyrano would be otherwise, because he is so smart and so good at everything. So I think really we just grabbed a hold of the humor that was there. Some of it was modernized, so it's a little bit more accessible. And then as actors, we get to add our own embellishments.
I mentioned Anthony Crane as Cyrano. Tell us a little bit more about your other fellow thespians on this production.
They're all just horrible people, and that's the only difficulty of working on the show. Insufferable, you know. It's actually the morale and the mood of a show makes a big difference, not only into how good it is to work on, but how the show actually ends up. And it's a really great cast. It starts a lot with Tony. It's his show. Mm-hmm. He carries the show. He's everywhere. And if he's not somebody that can that you can rally around, that can help keep morale high, then it breaks down. And yeah, I think eventually you see it on stage. And he's terrific that way.
New production of Cyrano at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts on Castro Street through the 1st of May. Mm-hmm. It's being presented by TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. So nice of Darren Bridget to come in and take a little time to tell us about the production.
David, it was my pleasure.
We look forward to the show.
Thank you.
Tune that has absolutely nothing to do with Cyrano de Bergerac, the production at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. TheaterWorks.org for more information. That's theater with an R-E. TheaterWorks.org for Cyrano by Edmund Rostand. Translated by Michael Hollinger and an adaptation by Michael Hollinger and Aaron Posner. TheaterWorks.org. Well, quite an event is shaping up for the 22nd of April up at Grace Cathedral. In partnership with the Consulate General of Ireland and Grace Cathedral and benefiting the Irish Immigration Pastoral Center, a commemoration of the 100th anniversary of Ireland's proclamation of the Irish Republic with Richard B. Evans' world premiere concert featuring a slew of wonderful musicians, one of whom joins me in studio today, a former concertmaster of the National Youth Orchestras of Ireland, Colm O'Rian. He was born in Limerick and is also a composer. Colm has been declared a genius fiddler by Mike Scott of the Waterboys. I'll have to explain that one. And his award-winning CD, Bridge Across the Blue, was cited by About.com as one of the top 7 recordings of poetry and music of all time. He's also taught at the Berklee College of Music at the University of Washington and also acted in the Academy Award-nominated film Steve Jobs. Colm, welcome to Open Air and KLW.
Good afternoon, sir.
Well, we've got quite a concert coming up. I say we because I'm also involved in this. I've been delighted to have been asked by Richard B. Evans to play some of his music at this amazing concert. There's quite a lineup of people.
Yeah, including the two of us. I mean, yeah, it's remarkable.
That'll be my Grace Cathedral Penny Whistle debut, I believe.
Debut? Is that where you're playing the whistle?
Whistle
and flute. Yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be, I think there's going to be about, 30 of us up on stage there. There's a full concert. Orchestra, a traditional ensemble, with some real stars coming over from Ireland for it, like Muireann McAuley. From your listeners may be familiar with the band Danu. She was the lead with Danu for the last 10 years. Christy O'Leary, the piper, Derek Ryan, and a few of us who made the journey a bit earlier than them, maybe 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Myself and Irish harpist Diana Rowan, who lived in the Bay Area. And a whole mixed voice choir, Celtic voices, and some members of the San Francisco Opera. You already had San Jose Opera represented today. But
indeed.
Yeah, so it's going to be quite exciting because I think what Richard B. Evans has done is remarkable. He's put what was a very poetic rebellion to music. Many of the leaders of the rebellion who were put to death in 1916. Next weekend is the centenary of the actual date that it happened. Many of them were poets. And I'm not sure that's representative of just the fact that lots of people in Ireland were poets or the fact that the poets saw an opportunity to sacrifice themselves for their freedom. And maybe the choosing of Easter was not coincidental. And so we're celebrating that next weekend by Richard B. Evans's putting to music of poetry by W.B. Yeats, Robert Emmet, James Connolly, Porrick Pierce, many of the great heroes of that time.
Well, Richard has a unique ability to really combine some traditional tunes with his own unique way of orchestrating and his own original music.
Right. Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to that because he's got some jazz background as well, which enables... He's a great fan of Sean O'Rea, though some of your listeners may be familiar with Misha Era, which was a great one of the initial crossover attempts between orchestral music and Irish music in the late 60s. But what Richard B. Evans brings to that is also knowledge of modal harmonies and jazz harmonies, which he applies to this. So, and then we're going to hear the singers sing the actual words of the poetry as well, so it's going to be quite something.
Well, let's hear Richard Evans himself describe the different styles that are involved in this program, and then we'll hear some live music from you.
The 16 musical movements of the Poet Patriots are arranged as a chronology of important events in Irish history, beginning in 1601 through 1916, and then finishing with reflections upon 1916 by W.B. Yeats, Francis Ledwidge, and George William Russell. So the musical styles in the Poet Patriots are wide-ranging. They include traditional Irish tunes. New airs in the style of Irish tunes. Art songs, which is a form of very popular European classical music, art songs in the manner of Schubert, Schumann, and so on.
I went out to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread.
And then also operatic approaches. Maud Gunn seems to me to have been a very operatic persona. And so I chose an operatic through composed style with soprano, orchestra, chorus.
Thank you.
to use an operatic style, though different, for Patrick Pearse's speech at the grave of O'Donovan Rossa, which seems to me a highly dramatic, highly operatic moment for him and for Irish history.
In this place we have laid the mortal remains of O'Donovan Rossa. This unconquered and unconquerable man.
Richard B. Evans explaining some of the music that will be heard for Ireland's Poet Patriots event, a musical tribute happening up at Grace Cathedral on the 22nd. Ireland's PoetPatriots.com is where you can relive that excerpt as well as learn more about the various things that are on that program. And I'm very pleased to be joined by a live musician who's going to be sharing some of his music, Colm O'Regan. Colm, tell us what you're going to play for us for a little first excerpt.
I'm going to play a few jigs. Ireland's known for jigs and reels. I'll play a few jigs for you. This one's called, I think, Tommy's Trip to Toronto. I think it's actually a Nova Scotian tune, but a lot of that comes from Ireland and Scotland.
Colm O'Regan here in studio. Studio at KALW. Colm is part of the cast of many that are involved in the 100th anniversary concert celebration of Ireland's proclamation of the Irish Republic, with Richard B. Evans' world premiere works being featured, along with San Francisco's Celtic Voices Choir, classical soloists from Ireland and the San Francisco Opera, some traditional vocal soloists in the Irish tradition, as we just heard, a full concert orchestra conducted by Maestro Kim Allen Klug, as well as some Bay Area Irish American luminaries serving as narrators. The event is on the 22nd of April. Information at IrelandsPoetPatriots.com. Colm, that's some fine, fine playing.
Thank you, sir.
So you say you make your home now here in the Bay Area.
I do.
It sounds like you have a more traditional Irish background yourself.
I do. I grew up speaking Gaelic as my first language.
Oh, wow, in Limerick.
Yeah, in Limerick. It's pretty unusual in an urban context, but... Yeah, I used to go down to Kerry, which is the West of Ireland, which is the Gaelic-speaking area, every summer for summer holidays, and we used to get our language and our music going.
So tell me, as a young lad growing up in Ireland, the music has to be embedded. Is there a certain point where you rebel against it too? Is that like, I hear another jig, I'm gonna like shoot my leprechaun?
No, not because, well, I had other forms of music as well to balance it out. Okay, so right. I grew up playing classical music, so that. But there are people who don't play who have that reaction sometimes because maybe they may not know. And sometimes, like, for example, people got oversaturated with Riverdance, potentially, and now there's a response to that. So, for example, they're doing this old style of dancing that's come back where the people are more free with their upper body and their hands because we've seen so much of Riverdance. And the same way with music, I think. I think it's a good point.
And so where was your study and knowledge of traditional playing come from?
From Kerry, from those summer holidays spent in Kerry. Okay. Uh-huh. And then the classical was growing up in Limerick in the School of Music where I was going to school there.
And what brought you to our fabulous Bay Area?
The fabulosity of it all. You answered the question. That's just, I feel very privileged to live in a place like this.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, part of a cast of, I would say, easily 100 or more that are going to be involved in this event, commemorating the 100th anniversary of Ireland's proclamation of the Irish Republic, featuring the music of Richard B. Evans. Information at irelandspoetpatriots.com. Let's hear some more music to finish out this hour of open air. What else you got for us?
Well, you've heard jigs already, so let me hit a few reels now.
All right.
Cool. Maybe just one, actually. This one's called Lord Frankton's Reel.
Okay. Great. Cole Morian here live in the studios of KLW. Studios. Thanks for sharing your wonderful music with us today, Colm.
You're welcome.
I look forward to performing with you for the Ireland Poet Patriots Concert on the 22nd of April. Next week, information at irelandspoetpatriots.com. Looking forward, Colm.
You too, David. Thank you.
Also happening this weekend, you should know about Sing for America's epic concert at the San Francisco Palace of Fine Arts. This show is all about movie music. In addition to the fundraising chorus, you'll have several amazing guests to hear, including Tony Award winner Michael McGuire, renowned vocalist Billy Valentine, and accomplished Broadway and Hollywood singer Julia Garnier. Information at singforamerica.org. Also, the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus presents Tales of Our City, Our Lives, Our Heroes, tonight and tomorrow night at Louise Davies Symphony Hall. Armistead Maupin will be by to share some of his wonderful stories from his writing, and the chorus will be under the direction of Dr. Timothy Selig. The chorus will be joined by the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, led by Dawn Harms for music of Shostakovich. Full disclosure, I'm also a part of that wonderful performance tonight at Davies Symphony Hall. Information for the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus special concerts tonight and tomorrow at sfgmc.org. My thanks to Niels Swinkles for producing Open Air. A reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. And if you have a segment suggestion, send me an email, David@kalw.org.